Bit of an introduction and then get into the second stage. This is 1, 2, 3 days on the same subject, and each day is a little different. The discussion is about largely around a book called American Civil Religion, called Russell Ritchie and Donald Jones, and which these two gentlemen have put together a number of essays, about 15, that deal with this topic of American civil religion, which tends to try to examine how faith in God shapes America, or how America's American life shapes faith in God, the relationship to the two.
You talk about the American relationship shaping God. How is that meant?
Shaping life, faith in God. How American life
shapes.
I may have skipped it. So now, how faith in God shapes America on the one hand, and how American life shapes faith in God on the other.
I just
that moving back and forth. And I chose to work with three essays in here. One is sort of the key essay in this whole movement of talking about civil religion. It was by Robert Bella. We spent a little time talking about that yesterday. Bella, in effect, says there is such a thing as American civil religion. I mean, the key statement at the opening of his essay, I'll read that. There actually exists, alongside of and rather clearly differentiated from the churches, an elaborate and well-institutionalized civil religion in America. He believes that that is there, and Bella's attitude is that that's not all bad. In fact, it probably had to be, and it represents a pretty solid understanding of how God works through nations. And so Bella is not too uptight about that. Now, he writes another essay, that was 1967. He writes another essay in 1974 at the end of the book, where he has a little more questions about it than that, but essentially he tends to affirm it. And he even says that it may have been better theology than some of the theology that was going around in the churches at that time, or generally in the past and now. So he has that implication as well. Today I want to talk about another essay in here by Martin Marty, which is titled Two Kinds of Civil Religion. And we'll get into that in a moment. Marty tends to be more in the middle on this subject and saying, I'm not so sure there is that much civil religion, and if there is, I'm not so sure that it's as powerful as people say they are, but if so, there are some different kinds working, and we ought to take a look at that. And tomorrow we'll deal with an essay by a fellow by the name of Richardson, Herbert Richardson, who is dead set against it. He thinks it's around, he thinks it's diabolical, and we ought to attack it and oppose it from the bottom of our feet to the tip of our toe, tip of our head. He's really against it. So we'll do that one tomorrow. Okay? In order to get into that, yesterday we talked a little bit about patriotism, what patriotism means to you. Just to get a little chatting among ourselves before I read some of the things in here. Today I'd like to ask you to tell me what it means to you to think about or even talk about separation of church and state. What does that mean to you? What's that about as far as you're concerned? It's a phrase you all have heard, I'm sure, right? What does that mean to talk about separation of church and state? Anybody?
Well, to some extent, it guarantees freedom of religion because it isn't under the control of the state and can't be subject to its domination and commands.
Okay. So the state cannot dictate what people believe, and that's why there is a separation of church and state, okay? Somebody else?
State decisions are not made on the basis of any theology, any religion, any specific religion.
Okay, so state decisions that are not made on the basis of a particular religious set of beliefs.
The state doesn't support the church.
The state does not support financially, give money to support the church. Anybody else? What does separation of church and state mean to you?
Roger Williams.
Pardon?
Roger Williams.
Roger Williams. All right.
Who's Roger Williams?
I thought he was. I thought he was a pianist. Anyone else?
Okay. If the state would not support the church, would that also mean that the church need not support the state?
What about that?
Taxes.
Pardon?
I say the church isn't taxed.
The church isn't taxed. You mean if church as church
doesn't
support it, she is saying.
Indirectly though, for example, a lot of nonprofit organizations are beginning to make outright contributions for like fire and police protection, which are there, and even though they are not obligated to pay, I know our Lutheran Lakeshore Home is one of the institutions, mm-hmm. and some churches even make just an outright donation.
Our congregation does every mm-hmm. year. We have a designated amount that we give back to the city for the fire and the
police mm-hmm. protection. Mm-hmm. That's an idea. I'd like to see them taken, that the church would pay taxes, really, because I think some churches have made such a, they have so much property. It's taken off of our tax roll. They've included a lot of, and it makes, actually we're paying, the rest of us are paying higher taxes because all that land is taken
off the tax roll.
Off the tax rolls.
Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's.
Pardon?
Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's.
Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's.
But I mean, we do expect like protection from if,
sure.
if the church is burglarized or if the fire or anything else.
Flood control, sewer, all the other kinds of stuff.
Sure. And then would we get tax deductions for those contributions that we make to the social order? If we pay on one hand, then do we also get tax deductions for taking care of things that the state does not provide for us?
What would you see those as being?
Or like Lutheran Social Service for one thing, Catholic welfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a difference. Maybe you'd be thinking more in terms of an income tax rather than a property tax, as you know, the specific services. Mm-hmm. An income tax, we'd say, hey, yeah, we have to pay some income tax, a corporate income tax or something, then maybe we should get something back for charities. But if this is strictly a land tax, which I understand.
Property tax, yeah.
I would say a property tax, in line with what she is saying, a church that's merely speculating, and many have, they have oil wells, I've heard, they've got real estate, large tracts of land they bought, they're speculating, and they're tax-free until they sell them. And for those, I would certainly say, but just for the place of worship, I would still like to see exemption remain.
What are the advantages? This wasn't really where the direction I was going, but just while we're around it. What are the advantages of being tax exempt? Well, what does that say? One obvious thing is you're saving some money, apparently. Huh? But it doesn't seem to me, would that be the foremost thing, that you want to save some money?
In the case of our own congregation, without tax exempt status, there wouldn't be one. We're in a small congregation in California, and California is losing church members right and left anyway in many places. If we had to pay taxes, that would be the end of our congregation as a physical unit. We'd be meeting in homes. So it's purely...
So survive, in your instance, it's survival.
Absolutely.
Taxation without representation. If you were taxed, then you would have a right to be represented in some way, wouldn't you?
Well, you mean, then Illinois Bell would have right to representation, and the churches would, more than any individuals? They pay taxes. Are you saying that institutions that pay would have certain kind of representation other than the normal votes that that citizens have? Is that what you're
saying? I'm not sure. I think it could become so. I think that won't be able to.
Okay.
Sometimes I think because we're not taxed, that we're tax-free, relieves churches of the obligation of involving community politics or something of that nature too, where taxes may force congregations involved in it, so they should be anyway, but I mean, mm-hmm. they force that. Thinking about it, no.
What else is, it seems to me there's more involved than what we've talked about in our desire to be tax-free, and I'm not sure what all of that is. But please, you had your hand.
Well, in our town, I've noticed two or three homes recently have tacked a sign outside that they're a church. Well, how many church is it?
Oh.
Well, the minute they decide to be a church, then that home isn't taxed anymore. That doesn't seem quite right.
Yeah, and if it's no judgment, we cannot turn very well to the, it seems to me, to the state and say, you tell us when something is a church.
Well, I don't know. It just doesn't seem right
on
either side.
Yeah, I'm saying, but in order to control that, we'd say, well, then they ought to have regulations. But then all of a sudden we are with the state determining when a church is a church is a church. Huh? Yes?
I think tax exemption is something in some way too. Courses or courses is a special status that the church likes to have, a separateness. Not necessarily that it's right, but that it's a demand for respect, whether it deserves it or not. Whether we deserve it or not, because it's bound to our noble existence or whatever. And as long as we get that, we're special.
Along that line, too, it might give us, too, the feeling that the knowledge, and a knowledge that's proclaimed that the church had the right, all these churches have the right to exist, have the right to exist in this country.
I see. Okay, please.
Well, I feel this way, that one of the reasons that you have anything that's tax exempt, that there's a kind of a duplication. You know, all those participating in the church, you know, they are property owners, and there is a tax base that is going out of them, and if you look at it in the broad sense, I feel that it's duplication of taxing. Sure, there are those that will never join a church or join a club or whatever, any organization that's tax exempt, but there are a lot of benefits that go to them that we participate in. There's no reason why they couldn't, in a sense, participate to take up the slack that church organization or other clubs that might be on that same basis.
But it seems to me that that argument, though, if for instance, my town, I pay taxes, and, you know, and I get that for protection. But if we build a church that is about three or four stories high, then my town has to buy a snorkel to take care of that fire protection over that church, which they don't need for my house, but they might need for a church with a what do you call them? So it seems to me you're getting something back. For, in other words, there's something more happening than just taking care of me for my taxes when I put up a structure or a school or whatever else, which is
again, the money's come out of that. The people that are in that community that are in, members of my church are also supporting. Yeah.
But if the church isn't right, but what I'm saying is, if the church isn't there, that wouldn't be necessary, and all my taxes would be used, and I still have to pay taxes. But if I add that, I do add a burden to the total community to do it. So something more has to come back out of those taxes. That's all I'm saying. It isn't like no cost comes to the community because of the buildings.
I think someone in that building and so forth are taking care of some of the community costs through them that the community isn't having to do through taxes too.
When you come to Lutheran
welfare or education,
in Lutheran social welfare, many congregations I know of are doing very little that the community would respond to as taking care of itself. Now, maybe more. If you're talking about counseling or something like that, that may be true. But many congregations I know of don't. That's a judgment on my part, I guess.
Isn't the power to tax, in a sense, the state having some power over the church, and isn't it being tax exempt, then the government does not have power over the church.
Symbolizes that lack of control, you say. Huh?
That seems to me is one of the major things we're speaking about.
How do you feel about that?
Good point. Was any comparison made to those places where they are tax supported?
The book doesn't deal with this at all. This is only mine.
Because I am afraid of the situation in Finland and Sweden, that for Sweden now is breaking away or have broken away, but there's always been this tax,
yeah,
a church tax, and many do resent the church tax because they don't take any part in the church. And so what other alternative would you have, you know, if they were to, if you were to look at it, have a church tax to pay to the state, or be exempt?
I heard one of our social workers saying the burden of the social service agency in the community is larger because the churches are there. They have more screwed up people coming in for counseling because of the religious institutions of the area. And that's one social worker speaking. So obviously you wouldn't get unanimity in saying that the church is a helpful agency in the town. It's interesting, the whole business. I guess I don't find many people talking about that very often, and I'm not sure how helpful it is, but I think we ought to explore some of those givens about the relationship between the church and the state that's around us. And only indirectly does that get us into the stuff that's in front of us today about the two kinds of civil religion that Marty talks about. As I indicated to you, that he sort of is not so sure it's as strong as everybody is saying, but he still is willing to recognize. Let me read some excerpts from this with the hope that you might get some ideas along the line, and I hope you would have some questions. I've written down questions that I have about this stuff that I'm going to read to you, so we ought to work that way. He thinks that there is a species that might be called a way of life religion. In other words, the way people see life is probably expressive of what they hold to be valuable and might be termed a religion. He's worried, though, when we call everything religion. He says, I'd like to stress that not everything having to do with how one puts a life together, even in the patriotic or nationalistic realm, must be viewed religiously. Some anthropologists and sociologists define religion so broadly that nothing can escape it. If everything is religious, then nothing is religious, and that bothers him. But it is, so in this sphere, as in others, it's important to allow for a cool, agnostic, disinterested approach. So he says, you know, don't get overwhelmed with all this. But he does pick up the theme of religiofication. In other words, how people make a religion out of something. That's a very important concept in Eric Hoffer's book of The True Believer, too. You want to put things together, all you got to do is begin to religify it, make it sound religious, or make it into a religious thing. And then you've got, dumb example would be the sauna. You know, like you would say, now that's a way of life, and people are better if they do that, and probably closer to God. You know, all of a sudden you're into a cult about it. You may not announce services, but you might be very much sounding like you have made a religion out of it. Some people do it out of coffee breaks, and I mean, there's a whole raft of things, I'm sure. The university that I work at, that goes on very broadly, because they tend to be almost all ex-religionists, you know, ex-Catholics, ex-Lutherans, ex-Congregationalists, ex-priests, ex-Lutheran, we've got, let's see, two ex-LCA ministers on our staff. And, they're all ex-something else. Then they tend to, I've noticed how much they religiofy other things. Things take deep religious meanings for people who are out of something else. And you often, for me, find as much about people in what they tend to religiofy as anything else. Marty goes on, the nation, state, or society is one of the most potent repositories of symbols in the modern world and can often replace religious institutions in the minds of people. He thinks it's a setup. So he doesn't say it couldn't happen at all. In fact, he says, you know, it's terribly vulnerable, because it tends to have the kinds of things that people can very easily make into religions. In fact, he suspects that on the another side of this coin, that Christianity and Judaism may have become civil religions rather than what they were. This line, Christianity and Judaism have now become civic religions, inculcating primarily devotion to the values of the community in which they exist, rather than a selfish or an anti, I mean, in contrast to a selfish and antisocial concern with personal, extra mundane salvation. They are held in a manner which allows complete toleration of rival objects of worship. And so he says it may be even that civil religion has taken over the traditional faiths in a sense.
Read that last, just that last sentence over again.
They are held in a manner which allows complete toleration of rival objects of worship.
What's they?
The Judaism and Christianity. I guess he's I hear him talking about what does it mean to be committed, you know, or is exclusivity your own faith? You say that this is really what I'm committed to, in contrast to these other things around you, and implying that if you have this, you have something better. Is that going by the board so that you can say, well, I'm really committed to this, but all these other people are committed to things that are maybe 180 degrees different, but that's okay too. If that's so, he's wondering whether Judaism and Christianity is closer to a civic or civil religion than it is to what it was, at least. He's raising that question.
Well, from the early church, for sure, it's a far cry. You know, they had things in common. So,
yeah.
Really on the,
Anyway, he points out that there would be a whole variety of them, just as there are in denominations, that the Roman Catholic Church, as he says, has room for votaries all the way from the garlic and babushka style to the vestigial Catholic ghetto to the social sophistication of the Berrigan brothers. You know, you can be anywhere in that. So you can have a whole variety of Roman Catholics. So also, you can have a whole variety of civic religion. It doesn't come down as neatly said, now, here is what it's all about. In fact, he stresses a couple times that it really doesn't have that concrete a doctrine that you can pin it down. He says, you can look at it two ways. The sociologists see civil religion as a social construction of reality. Here's the reality in which we live with, and so we construct something around it to give us some meaning. Or the historians look at it more as symbolic history. That's what's happened to us, and that symbol is what really keeps us going. For instance, he said, the Reformation or the Middle Ages or the Industrial Revolution didn't really occur. You know, there wasn't an event. You said, there it was. Look, there's the Industrial Revolution. Or there is the Reformation. We load that with meaning. And so we can say, the Reformation changed, the Industrial Revolution did this. We give those symbols meaning. He says that's another way of saying what civic religion does. Looks at its history and says, wow, look at that. And so the American story becomes a very rich symbol that people get tempted to live by because we tend to live by our symbols. So those are the ways to look. And then he has this paragraph that I thought was interesting. While people in society may be merely or utterly secular, godless or religionless, in practice, in a complex culture, their lives cohere, and his key word is that, cohere around certain symbols and myths. If they did not, there would be spiritual anarchy and anomie. The churches and synagogues, it is said, do not fulfill the old functions of providing enough coherence for enough people. They do for some, but not for enough people, he is saying. The sectarian, particular, and private faiths tend to divide people rather than provide coherence. They're cut up into different pieces. They therefore naturally cohere around national symbols. If we are very different when we get together in our churches and we're looking for coherence, we look for it where we can find it, and the possibility is that we find it in our national symbols. He quotes William Butler Yeats, once said that one can only reach out to the universe with a gloved hand, and that glove is one's nation, the only thing one knows even a little about. And so if we reach out for any meaning beyond ourselves, Yeats is suggesting you do that only through the nation. The nation provides many people with a source of identity and power. The nation then becomes more than a political process or political decision-making. It provides some context for meaning and for belonging. And he says that's maybe a very, very normal thing for to happen. People got all upset about the civil religion, and Marty said they were extreme in their response because they overlooked the positive values of such a civic religion. They underestimated the need for social cement. How can you have a country that doesn't believe things together? If we all had believed different things, it would never have become a country. They tend to use a double standard for measurement. They fear competition for the sects, defenders of civil religion, the academy, during the moment when they can cheer current manifestations of the faith, are often called social realists. They really think that's a real way to look at it. If you push that to its end, we'd probably have, he'd say, we would have an infinite number of civil religions. Everybody would have their own, but it doesn't work out that way. Because citizens are enraged when the national anthem cannot be played at an athletic event. You say you can't play it here, but they don't sing it when it is. And they're favored by a 4-1 majority of a constitutional amendment that would allow for prayer in schools. But they didn't pray when it was okay to do it. And so, you know, it's not that clean that everybody just wants it to be that way. Let's get on. He sees then the four kinds of possibilities. A nation under God, in other words, a religion that sees itself under God in what he calls a priestly role, which sort of helps mold people together, and a prophetic role in which it talks against itself and corrects itself. Those are the first two modes that he sees. The second modes are a nation of national self-transcendence in which they're just sold on themselves. The nation becomes the religion and the God. And again, he sees that as a means of molding people together on the one hand or criticizing itself on the other. And he thinks all four of those are going on, and that's why it's so hard for people to really believe that something's going on. It doesn't come clean for us. Now, I don't know whether Marty helps us or he doesn't, but that's the direction that he goes in. Let me just make a couple of quotes about that, and then we'll now stop. The phrase under God appears in Abraham Lincoln's addresses and after. That's when it really got started, when we started talking that way. Although, as we said yesterday, it was in the implications were all there in the Declaration of Independence as well. The God under whom the nation lives will probably be pictured and symbolized in terms similar to those used by particular religions within a nation. The deity gives identity, meaning, and purpose to the nation. It represents a promiser to the nation. There was something was going to happen. And then he traces that most of that was from deism, and then from denominational background of Puritan, Evangelical, Catholic, or Jewish forebears. There was an addressable God created, and that God is taken over and used in the civic religion. Or it has to be in terms of national sentiment, a civil religion that is included. Also, automatically, under this category, you have an inclusive God. Whether you have him all worked out in Father, Son, and Holy Ghost or not, the sentiment is that he ought to be inclusive. And that helps pull things together for people. That's what Marty says. The prophetic mode, he traces Jonathan Edwards, Abraham Lincoln, and Reinhold Niebuhr especially, in which the prophetic mode speaks out and corrects the nation when it's wrong. Lincoln really went after it, and you got two parts of the country, both praying to the same God, both reading the same Bible, both asking for the same results in the war, and one of them's going to be wrong. And you got to deal with that. That wrong possibility of being wrong is what he works at. The third category, the third mode, was this self-transcendent nation, that when they talk about a promise to America becomes the promise of America. Rather than God doing something for us, America can do it for us. This is the land, the golden opportunity. And here he traces some of the people. On the right wing, symbolized by Nixon in this case here, or on the left wing, where he quotes a number of people where democratic ideals become the ultimate authority.
Would that include such things as Manifest Destiny?
Yes.
And John Cotton's The City Set on the Hill to be an example to the nation.
Exactly, right. That would be more the first of the priestly mode, because then you'd be coming and going. It would be the priestly mode of the self-transcendent. That's correct, because that would move people together. We have this manifest destiny, and we all must go. Right. That would be more the first of the priestly mode, because then you'd be coming and going. It would be the priestly mode of the self-transcendent. That's correct, because that would move people together. We have this manifest destiny, and we all must go. Right. And the last part is the prophetic one, in which our ideals, not in terms of God thought, you know, God words, but our ideals have not been reached. And so we correct ourselves by saying, we got to keep moving towards those ideals. There isn't justice, and justice is seen as more than simply the courts doing their job, but people living justly together. And since we haven't realized those ideals, we tend to correct ourselves in terms of those ideals, and civic religion then plays that role. Marty ends up thinking that probably civil religion will end up having more Catholic substance and Protestant principle. And he suspects that's the way it'll come out later on. But we ought to have a tradition, according to Marty, of Mark Twain, Mr. Dooley, Will Rogers, and Mort Saul to prevent people from taking the claims and the counterclaims of civil religion so seriously. He still thinks we ought to be very cautious about buying in and saying that it's doing as much as it seems to do. He quotes Harold Macmillan. And Harold Macmillan was criticized for not giving his people a sense of purpose. He replied that if people want a sense of purpose, they should go to their archbishops. And he wondered if that kind of message isn't still the message we ought to be trying to get across to people today. That's what Marty tries to say about civil religion. Sort of, as I said, in the middle ground. But let me ask the question that bothered me most. Do you think it's true that the denominations today, Judaism and Catholicism and whatever they may be, and Protestantism, do not offer enough coherence to enough people so that it is true that they will be seeking coherence for life outside? That was Marty's contention, one of his contentions.
Well, the human individual is always seeking, and there are certain vacuums that come along, and they feel a need to satisfy them. If they don't find them in one place, they will find them elsewhere. I'm a believer in that. You take a person who has quit the church or has become recalcitrant, he will find a substitute for any other vacuums that might have been created.
I don't think religion as we experience it is holistic enough to give that coherence. I think it could be and should be, but isn't.
Can you illustrate those things that are missing that make that real for you?
Well, mostly I can speak to that in that religion tends to be concerned with being spiritual, and that it ought not to only be concerned with those things, but with everyday things that are just part of normal human existence, and that we tend to separate them as being spiritual and secular when they should all be governed under our life in Christ.
Somebody got a reaction to that? Or do you agree or disagree, or got other feelings about that? Yeah.
I can agree with that. Because even in, like, there's so many different types of so-called Christian theology. Like, there's black theology, yep. There's theology of hope, theology of glory, you know, and all of that. And I think each one kind of represents a certain lack that's there, you know, something that's missing in Christianity as we get it, you know, for some reason. And, you know, simply because something else is missing, then someone else picks up on that and then makes that the whole focus of their theology.
Okay. Yeah.
I can see in those synodactyls just that I think that there's two of, at least for myself, in experiencing association religiously or otherwise with other people, sort of a band of commonness we can operate in, and there is no way that can be broadened to infinitely. It's this we have in common, and we'll live in that commonness, but I extend way out too, and that's why when you talk about a holistic religion, I think it would be really difficult, maybe impossible to do that just because of the differences in people, and you can stage central and communion in gospel and some central things, but beyond that I think it's hard to push for a community and push people into being the same in that way.
Anybody?
I got a question.
Sure.
Could there be like a purpose maybe all the differences in people's Christian beliefs I'm talking about? Because it seems as though if something becomes the norm, then it gets bottled up and packaged and commercialized and you institutionalize it. You know, you practically say, this is it. And the fact that there's always differences coming in and out, you know, it keeps it, I don't know, it keeps us honest or something. It keeps us from, kind of like she said, it keeps us from setting a norm and trying to box people in.
How about it? How do you feel about that?
Well, I would agree that, you know, a person just is too diversified to some people fit a form, but most people don't. And those that could be completely satisfied to be Puritans, well, they will be Puritans, but then you're going to get some of the others that will partly Puritan, and there you've broken it up already.
But if civil religion is the substitute, is that just something that's watered down enough to be palatable to everybody?
What do you think?
Seems like to me that's the purpose of civil religion, is to have a little something for everybody, to kind of make it the norm. You know,
a watered-down version, right?
Yeah, it's watered down, but I think it's considered the norm. You know, it's kind of like civil religion is, you know, if you buy into it, it's okay, but if you get too carried away in any type of religion, then people get upset. You know, if you really go whole hog into any type of religion, people get upset. But if you get into civil religion, a nice passive kind of approach, then, you know, people can handle that. And I was just wondering if that isn't the purpose of civil religion, to have a nice norm.
Instead of making it negative that it's a norm and that type of thing, maybe you could say that it's a stripping of, you know, all of the accoutrements that would go along with the religion, and just making us one central, like a supreme being type thing, and simplifying it and not making it seem in a negative way, but or a watered down way. In other words, you just, those other things become less important and not essential to the one central.
Would you say that the Declaration of Independence is a proclamation of our civil religion? And that sure isn't watered down. Not that we follow it. Mm-hmm. But would that be a...
I don't know. I've read the Declaration, so I don't know whether I'd be willing to say what I feel about it without having read it again from that perspective. I guess I too have a feeling that the civil religion that was being talked about here isn't necessarily very watered down, because it's set up to get people to give their life in the time of a crisis. and I mean literally, to die for your country. The civil religion, and again, if you take civil religion seriously, and as you say, we don't take that any more seriously, perhaps, than other religions are taking seriously, you would have to be for everybody to have a free choice, because part of it is equality, and part of it, civil religion, we talk very strongly about justice for everybody. Now, it isn't lived out very well, any more than even everybody dying is, but it doesn't seem to be watered down in that sense. Now, it may be watered down in the sense of a revealed religion. We would say, you know, it doesn't deal with revelation. It doesn't deal with God's acts in history outside of our own American experience as well, nor does it deal with Jesus Christ as a revelation of that supreme being that we're talking about. In that sense, I agree with the watered down, but if you take it in terms of demands and expectations, might be even more than some of the other religions. I don't know, that somebody else got a reaction to that.
I think that maybe that there would be, I mean, it's too general a statement, but more people who would be willing and feel better about dying for their country rather than dying for their savior. I mean, if it came right down to it, you say, would you go out and spend your life for Christ and give up everything, or would you go out and fight for your country and perhaps be killed and be gallant? More people would be willing to do that.
You agree with that?
Probably. Historically, it's your turn.
There was a time when that wasn't that separated, you know, when they said, let's go out and die for your country and Christ and go on a crusade and go and do the whole thing and holy wars.
Well, America has always seen her wars as holy.
Yeah, right.
Every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But then if the civil religion is believing in kind of like a newer God or something, then that would make the country then the God, right?
Well, Marty maintains that there's two kinds in which there is still a God that is beyond the country and correcting the country when it's wrong. And there's another kind that does make the country the God. There are two strands that he sees. So, you know, you take your pick. In one sense, what you say is right, in another sense, it isn't. Lincoln really assumed there was another being that was judging what was going on. It wasn't just that the best man wins and that must be right. There was somebody judging. Go ahead.
So much of what the country does is based on economics, you know, and a lot of decisions are made just from the mere fact of how much power, economic power, one could gain out of a given situation. And that would seem to make then the country the God, because you want to strengthen the country rather than some outer being, because I don't see like an outer, if there was an outer being, then your reasons for doing something would go beyond economics. I can't think of very many decisions that, you know, the government made that didn't directly benefit America.
Yeah. See, what you have to allow for in civic religion is that a being out there is in favor of the country. You know, that's how he gets to be the civic religion. The association of the polis, the country, and the God is very close. It conceives of a God that sees this country as being great. And therefore, when you make a political decision economically, you're doing that in behalf of the country which the God says is great.
Also, when America has made those political decisions which has been for their economic benefit, they rarely admit that that's their motivation.
Oh, yeah.
They disguise it. You know, this is the moral thing to do, that America is guarding the freedom of the nations, and that's the primary motivation rather than economic gain.
But the strong rebellion of the Vietnam protesters, was it rebellion against the civil religion, or was it against the, or what they sensed to be
just the falsehood, you know, that they began to see through what the government was trying to hide, like she mentioned, that they did, the motive.
I don't know if it's trying to hide as much as hiding it from themselves.
They may even believe it, you're saying.
Yeah, that there's a dual kind of motivation, and what they would choose to believe is that America is a moral country, rather than America is a country out for economic welfare.
You mean just the immoral? Is that what
you're
You say immoral?
No, that America is moral.
Oh, but why wouldn't they have fought then? You know, why were there so many that rebelled if they thought it was moral?
I think that the objectors in Vietnam were objecting to maybe the blindness of the leaders, that what they were doing wasn't moral as they thought or as they said.
Well, they must have thought they were immoral.
Well, the objectors did.
Yeah.
But I don't think the people that perpetrated it.
Yeah, she was talking first about the leaders.
Pardon me.
Yeah, the leaders.
Yeah, I mean, those that. That ran away, the detectors.
Yeah, they thought it was immoral.
Yeah.
Well, where do they make the switch? Where do people make the switch then, in the sense giving themselves to this civil God? You know, like anybody who is poor, I would think have a different opinion of the civil God than, say, like those who are in the higher up positions. And somewhere along the line, a switch takes place.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere between when they were poor to when they got, you know, came into power, or the switch takes.
Sure.
What does
Hoffer? I don't have an answer to that, except Hoffer says that it would not take place among the very poor. The very poor believe. They have high hopes, and they will work and intend not to attack the system. It's the people who are just beyond being very poor, you know, still plenty poor, but no longer abject poverty. They begin to have the questions, and then they're the ones who tend to fight and rebel and become part of, you know, the true believers in revolution. And then, I don't know where the line is, but as you go beyond that, the way you take care of a revolution is to give the people what they're looking for. You know, if they're fighting for more money, then you give them the money, and then they become the institution. And they buy in, and they begin to say, well, now, this new thing we have, so we fought, and we got this money, we got whatever, our jobs or housing or something else, then they become soldiers in their way being it. Somewhere behind them is somebody coming up who says, hey, wait a minute, I haven't got that either. And then they become true believers coming up. I don't know where that line is, but Hoffer contends that when you give people what they think is missing in their life, if it's either money or housing or job or freedom of worship or whatever it is, then they tend to become believers in what they have. And somebody else coming after them begins to question that.
Well, I think in terms of a lot of, when I was in college, you know, everybody was against something. It was like in the 60s and early 70s, early 70s. And now a lot of those people who were against so much in college, you know, they're out and they're working and they got jobs. And a lot of that's gone and a lot of that's missing.
Right.
And somewhere the switch took place, and I'm not sure if it's because of they got necessarily what they wanted. Maybe, I don't know.
I don't know. My personal belief is that it's very much attached to getting that. But I couldn't prove it to you. I can't say, here's the way it works. I believe that it has to do with that. Because, you know, many of my oppressed friends who have gotten, you know, leads and jobs and all that stuff, all of a sudden they were not, they became the oppressors. I watch them. Mm-hmm. And it happens in me, too. Yeah.
And that's the way your religion works too, in a way, is that you identify yourself with your country because it gives to you what you need, and when it doesn't do that, you don't identify with it, like the draft resistors and people like that. And to a large extent, religion works that way. Mm-hmm. To Christianity does, you identify yourself with this God because you're getting all the things you're getting, the love and all that kind of thing. And your identification with that goes as far lack of times, it seems, as measure getting.
Okay. So what you're saying then that, you know, if like you're down and out, Christianity serves you, you know, and then when you get a little better on the spectrum, then Christianity no longer serves a purpose, and the government does more for you, or the nation, as far as providing you with a job and money, than Christianity did. And then if something else comes along that even takes the place of maybe the nation itself, maybe.
Could be.
That takes the place?
For some people, what you're saying I think is very true. Is that they really, although they may be very active in churches, Christians or whatever, and affirm it, in their heart of hearts they believe their problems could be solved by the government and money. And therefore, you know, their faith then may well be in the government money and not in what they believe, what they say in their religious thought. I think that's very possible. That's why it seems to me that the church is called to be not only priest, which says, hey, things are great and you're getting what you want, but prophet, which says, hey, man, it ain't great and there is a need for something beyond getting what you want and becoming, you know, more so. That's the prophetic role that Marty thinks is missing in civil religion a lot of time, and a lot of us would think is also missing in the Christian faith and in Christian congregations. That we do a very good job of comforting those who are in need, but to disturb those who need to be upset, we have a great deal of difficulty doing that. And here it's often economic too. Many a pastor or many a congregation, I want to lay on a pastor, many a congregation, including the pastor, won't get at something critical simply because there's a financial risk involved. And, you know, and somebody's going to pay the bills next month. Somebody's going to get a salary next month, wherever it is.
Well, I think it's true of all of our life and makeup, you know,
sure.
That people will take one job and you get a promotion, you decide. Is there satisfaction? Is there a feeling of accomplishment? And then you weigh it against the new promotion, the salary, the hours involved, and risks. And
sure.
So that I really like what he was, the questions he was answering, I think is really a portrayal of life. And just whatever stage you're at, mm-hmm. then you somehow try to fit into it. In fact, I think that you take it with marriage. In America, I think this has become a kind of a norm for that too. Well, fine, everything goes along good, things don't go so good, we break up, we're going to try it all over again, get a new model, and keep on going.
And it's because of that kind of thing that we were talking about, that Herbert Richardson feels very strongly that American civil religion probably demonstrates the worst kind of religion, and it has to be counteracted with what he feels is a revealed religion, a specific, and as I said yesterday, an institutionalized ecclesiology. An institutional outfit has to be a live option. There have to be something else you can believe in that is concrete, not only abstract, that is set beside. That's why the emphasis on individualism in the religious, in Christian faith today, for some people, it's a very annoying thing because that keeps it all on one base. And you don't get together in a corporate interdependence because then you might have something that could stand as an alternative to believing in the state. And that's why somebody said that, you know, yesterday, what was Mormonism a sign of it? I think Mormonism would be a threat to civil religion in one sense because there is corporateness that they work at. On the other hand, it tends to buy into the very satisfactions that the state offers. And it may be, you know, it may be more of a problem that way too.
I have two questions.
Sure.
And I'm not sure. Maybe we asked one of them yesterday.
It's all right.
But does another, America, is America the only nation of the civil religion?
No.
I mean, is it basically, no, what am I trying to say? Is it basically affluent nations, civil religions?
Oh no, not at all. Any nation, and particularly a beginning nation, has a civil religion. and it's expressed usually, you know, in its hopes. Before we have been cut up, like the African nations today would be very strong examples of it. Before we've been cut up and we weren't anything at all, and now we shall become a nation. And that is often identified with the fates, the gods, the God, or whoever it may, in this case may be. It's God's will that we be free. It's God's will we have autonomy. And wango. So it's probably even stronger at the start. Well, like the guys at the rewriting of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. They were calling on God like mad to affirm what we are doing as the beginning of a nation. But that would be true the sociologists think in any group, but particularly this debate says that any nation has it, and particularly beginning nations would be strongly susceptible to it, mainly because the group doesn't survive unless you have something beyond. And as soon as you get to something beyond what you are, you know, the hope, the up there, you've moved into the possibility of the transcendent. And often it is specific. Our gods want us to do this and to be this.
Is this a very calculated thing? I mean, do they sit down and really plot it out?
Some do. If our friend Hoffer is right about true believerism, there's always a core of thinkers and writers who do that kind of work. Somebody else comes along after a while and does the work and gets rid of the thinkers and writers.
I think in America that's true.
Yeah.
There was a very conscious effort in the beginning of our country to create an American culture.
Jefferson was...
To get rid of the old and to make something brand new, which was American. And it was conscious, totally.
And it was deist, in the same, I mean, you know, and included that the whole concept of Israel, the new Israel and all that stuff, very consciously. The writers did that.
Bolshevik revolution.
Yeah.
Perfect picture.
Right.
Something new, something better, something great. The final answer.
Anyone else? We're running out of time. I don't want to keep you
too. Do you define National Socialism as a type of civil religion?
Yeah.
Or is it more strictly nationalism?
Well, and nationalism would be a form of a civic religion. Again, Richardson tomorrow makes a strong case on that when a nation becomes a state and begins to take on, you know, rule out the possibility of many nations, it's focused in one direction, as National Socialism tends to do, then the danger almost inevitably, it leads into a form of religious thought and commitment. Yeah, would be he'd feel very strongly about that, and I would agree with him. A poem from Jim Carroll to close. Okay, this is about a prayer for untroubled people. It picks up the note about just comforting folks all the time. And it comes out of his reaction to Isaiah 43: "I am the Lord; besides me, there is no savior." His prayer is: "Pity the perfect ones, who never have been lost in fruitless torments of why, for God's sake, this." Pity the husbands, wives, who never mourn the loss of a oneness they never truly had. Pity the preacher whose words have never rung with emptiness. Pity the unangry person who never shook at the release of sudden power. Pity the teacher with every answer and no confusion ever. Pity the brave who never cower cold with fear to sink a charging fleet of hearts. Pity the well-dressed who never quiver naked, exposed body and self to another's red gaze. Pity them all, O Lord. Coax them out of hiding into the full, dreadful circle of creaturehood, of being human, of, oh, knowing it so. You lost yourself in us, O Lord, quivered naked, troubled, sick save sin. In your lostness we are finally found. When our sanity goes as it is doing now, your sense is ours. There is you for us. Pity those who never fail, for they do not taste the great unfailing you. They are never battered in the dear torment of this desperate love, whether of you or other failures like your son. Let it be that we did not too pretend. For now let us stand, as we surely will then, troubled, stunned, naked, failing, and found by you. James Carroll. Thanks for being here. Hope you can be here tomorrow. We'll talk about Herbert Richardson in American Civil Religion.
Thank you.